Coming up, wait till you hear the surprising way that today's guest found his co-founder. If you know anyone who's looking for a technical co-founder or any other kind of co-founder, you're going to want to watch that part of the interview. Also, if you're looking for big customers, check out how today's startup lands giants. All that and so much more coming up, so stay tuned. Three messages before we get started. First, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone who works at your company can be reached no matter where they are? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. Next, does anyone you know need a beautiful online store that actually increases sales but is easy to set up and manage? Send them to shopify.com, the platform that top online stores are running on right now. Finally, do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world that you and I live in? Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. I've known Scott Edward Walker for years, so tell him you're a friend of mine and he'll take good care of you. Here's the program. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does a founder who felt like he could never come up with a business idea end up launching a hit company with clients that include the Miami Dolphins, Pepsi, and Sony Music? Irving Fain is the co-founder of CrowdTwist, which has incredible customers and provides them with an advanced multi-channel customer relationship and loyalty platform. This interview is part of my series of interviews with founders whose companies were launched and with the help of Techstars. David Cohen, the co-founder of Techstars, helped me put this and many other interviews together. So, Irving, welcome and thanks for doing this interview.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah, me too. So there was a time, right, as I said in the intro, where you weren't sure what your next big business was and you were going swimming, trying to find it, right?
Can you tell us about that time? I'm not sure that swimming was related to the finding of the idea. I wish I did not swim to find the idea. I think I swam to just get myself, have a little respite from the search for an idea as well as the day-to-day grind of my job at the time. But yeah, you know, I think I had always been an entrepreneur at heart, always knew that I was going to do something entrepreneurial. But the question for me for a while was, what was that right idea to really dive into 150%?
Can you talk a little bit about that time? Because frankly, I was remembering this, not remembering this morning, I was feeling it this morning. I said, there needs to be a next step for Mixergy, and I'm really struggling with what it is. And there's no clear path for figuring out what the next step is and how to do it. And it's frustrating, but maybe if I could see it through your eyes, I can feel a little bit better about my experience and understand what I can do to get it right. Because frankly, you got it right. So talk a little bit about the struggle.
So I think you're very kind and generous to say you got it right. And I think I would almost say that it's hard to say that anybody's ever gotten it right at any point. Even the big established companies are constantly evolving and iterating to make sure they continue to get it right, which I think really shows that it's a process at the end of the day. And every business from early stage companies with a couple of people hacking on an idea to companies that are thousands and thousands of people, I think iteration and evolution is an underpinning of all of those different circumstances. And so to me, what that really means is that the most important way to start that process is to start that process. And it sounds intuitive in a lot of ways, but there are a number of ways. There's millions and millions of ways that you can talk yourself out of starting a company, or talk yourself out of evolving your product or iterating your company because it doesn't make sense. It's risky. It doesn't seem to be what's sensible. It's dangerous. I mean, there's so many different ways of looking at it. And I think that one of the most important qualities is just being willing to initially take that risk and take the plunge and actually start on the journey. Because what you realize is along the way of that journey, you're going to learn a lot from your customers, from your clients, from your users, from yourself.
There was this period where here's what you told Jeremy, our producer. You said, at one point, I felt like we were in constant state of waking up in the morning to go swim, then go to work, then come home and work on ideas until 11 p.m. and then wake up and do it all over again. And there's an internal struggle there as well as the external struggle to come up with something for a product for clients. What was that?
Yeah, I think it's just, you've got to find something you believe in and you're passionate for. Mm-hmm. And that was the struggle for us, was that we, so I had been an entrepreneur at heart. That was always my goal, was to do something of my own. I'd been on the sort of the finance side and the buy side for a while. I then flopped over to really get some operating experience. I was working at Clear Channel. And so I was waking up in the morning, going to the pool, going to work, coming home at night with one of my co-founders at the time, and we would sit around our kitchen table and we'd spend 3 or 4 hours just talking about different ideas. And there was a sense at that time of really immense frustration, just because we knew we wanted to be building something, but we felt that what we were building, we needed to have the passion and the excitement for, and we just didn't have it for each of these ideas.
What are some of the ideas that you had that, looking back on?
There's some funny ones. So one of the ideas I still think is interesting is something in the ticketing space, which we didn't end up pursuing for a number of reasons. But even there, I look at it now and I say, you know, knowing what I do now, if I'd known that back then, we probably could have dove into that idea.
What was the idea?
The idea was variable pricing for the primary ticket market. So the same way that you have variable pricing in the secondary market on StubHub, the notion would be that you could offer variable pricing for the primary ticketing market for the first time someone sells tickets. A lot of complexities and nuances to that.
Yeah, what's the challenge for that? Right now, all the tickets cost the same. And then StubHub or scalpers will often buy those tickets and then charge me as much as they can get based on market demand. So what's the challenge with cutting out the middleman and just having variable pricing off the bat?
Yeah, God, there's so many challenges. Really? That's a whole conversation of itself. But the big players own the big venues and the relationships. And those are things that they hold on pretty tight to and sometimes will even pay to maintain. So as a small company, to try to leverage your way in there is difficult. And what we found is the easier inroad would be to smaller venues and smaller rooms, but those venues and rooms typically didn't have shows that were as exciting. So the upside on the variability was limited and the downside was the more likely outcome. So you were creating a model that would potentially depress the price of tickets, not increase them. And the venues where you would really see that revenue benefit were owned by other players who are going to be very, very difficult to unseat. So
how do you discover that? What kind of research leads you to have this understanding?
This is a funny thing I think about. You know, people ask me a lot, you know, when we started Crowdsys, you know, did we spend too much time thinking about this stuff? Did we spend not enough time thinking about pieces? You know, we spent months and months working on that idea, you know, everything from building a financial model to creating a deck to present to people to researching the ticket market, to talking to venue owners, and just to get a sense of how did the market work, what did it mean, what was the opportunity, scoping out what the product would look like. We carried down a number of different paths to try to evaluate whether that was or wasn't the right opportunity.
All right. You also had one business idea that you followed for 6 months. Was that this ticketing idea or something else?
Ticketing idea.
So 6 months of doing research, but not necessarily launching anything.
Which was a tough moment for us. That was what Jeremy was referring to from that, when he and I spoke, was that, you know, I had invested an immense amount of myself in being an entrepreneur, not in an idea, which is a nuance, but an important distinction. And we sort of continued to build momentum around this ticketing idea. And I think what really hit us was when somebody handed us a couple of contracts from Ticketmaster and showed us that they were years and years and years long with immense amounts of dollars attached to it. We kind of looked at ourselves like, wow, this is going to be really difficult to build this business, no matter how compelling of an idea we have. And that moment where we had to look at ourselves and say, okay, you know what? We want to do something, we want to build a business, but this isn't the business that we should build, was a tough one, because we'd invested so much of our time, so much of our energy, and it felt like starting from zero. I think in hindsight now, looking back on it, we weren't really starting from zero, because we learned about the evaluation process itself and what work was valuable that we did, what work was maybe not necessary. And so that allowed us, when we did come on the idea of Crowdsys, to be much more efficient and effective in our evaluation.
What's one thing that you did?
It came after tickets and before Crowdsys. We didn't spend too much time on that one.
Oh, there was something before Crowdsys and after the ticket business. What was that?
We looked at a babysitting concept, the notion of something around the world of babysitting, connecting babysitters with families who needed babysitters. But we spent much less time on that than 6 months on tickets.
So what was one thing that you did right in evaluating the ticketing business and one thing that you wished that you hadn't wasted your time on?
I think the most important thing we did right was figuring out everything that could potentially be wrong with the business. What I say to people all the time is that if you can't identify a number of potential issues and pitfalls and problems with your business, then you're not looking hard enough. Because no matter what your business is, no matter how compelling of an idea you've created, there are always pitfalls and potential problems. Google, Facebook, Instagram, like, you know, these Pinterest, the companies, Airbnb, you know, sort of the rock stars of the moment right now in the world of technology, even today have plenty of pitfalls, let alone when they were starting up. So we were very, very critical of the idea, the market, the opportunity as we were starting to really make sure we understood the risks that were at play.
Okay.
I think the question then becomes where is critical and then where is too critical? Because there is a point at which you can talk yourself out of pretty much any idea.
I see. That's a good point. All right. So that's something that you did do right. Where did you waste your time in evaluating that first ticketing business?
You know, I think we did a lot of great work. Did we need to kind of create as many materials as we did and things like that? I'm not convinced we did. You know, luckily it's in the rearview mirror at this point.
What kind of material?
We'd created a presentation to go bring the folks. We created, you know, a whole pretty complicated financial model. I think there's benefits because it helped us understand the economic opportunity. I'm really a believer that you've got to build businesses that have monetization. I know there's a lot of attractiveness to building a user base and then figuring out monetization later, but I may be old school, but I do think that thinking about the economics of a business is important, but we did spend a lot of time thinking about that. Hard to tell if it was right or wrong. Here I am today, right?
Speaking of monetization, what size revenues are you guys doing now?
Not something we disclose, but we've had healthy growth from last year to this year, which is the right trend, and looking to have, you know, healthy growth moving into next year also.
Okay,
that's a while away.
All right, I knew from my notes that you weren't willing to talk about it, but I always like to try. What were you doing just before, while you were looking for your ideas? What was that job?
So I was working at Clear Channel in their digital division. So I was helping to run the digital arm of the biggest radio group in the world. And we were really kind of the national organization around 1,000-something stations across the whole country. So we managed their sites, their technologies, the different platforms, different, you know, applications or opportunities that came out so we could roll them out to the entire radio portfolio.
Okay. And even though you had that job and you'd had other jobs before, let me see if I can find associate at Trellia Partners, analyst, private equity, you always were an entrepreneur at heart. In fact, you did something that you mentioned StubHub. The founder of StubHub came here and he told me about how he used to sell toys and candy when he was in school. You did something like that too, right?
I was always looking for the next business idea. I mean, I told Jeremy a story of when I was very, very young. I used to go down to the corner store, a place called Harrison's, where I grew up in Providence. And I'd buy these little rubber animals for, you know, 10 cents or whatever they were. And then I'd go home and I'd take a Tupperware container and I'd siphon it off into a number of different compartments. And I'd put all the animals in and then I'd go to the playground and I'd sell the animals out for 25 cents to all the kids in the playground. I went to a Quaker school, and playground commerce was not one of the attributes that they were really trying to encourage. So that business didn't last very long. But between that and building snow shoveling businesses and raking leaves, and I had actually a quite lucrative business that started as a lemonade stand and grew into T-shirts and roses. That I ran all the way up until I was 19 years old and grew to be fairly sizable. So I was always chasing after different projects and building different businesses.
And you were shut down with the T-shirt business because you didn't have the right trademarks. You were just creating T-shirts.
We were creating T-shirts for the local college. And what ended up happening, we were victims of our own success. People liked our T-shirts so much and so much more than the standard sort of boring T-shirts from the college that they were going into the bookstore in droves asking for our T-shirt designs, at which point the bookstore sort of said, hey, clearly someone's doing something out there and it's not our T-shirts. we need to find this. And then all of a sudden the local campus police rolled up on our place. They took our t-shirts and so ended our business.
You know what? I should move past this, but I can't. The fact that you sold little rubber animals while you were in school and were shut down for it really irritates me. I hear this a lot in interviews. The same thing happened to the founder of StubHub. The same thing happened to me. The same thing happened to so many other kids. You know, if you're a kid and you pee your pants in school, they will make you feel okay about it. They'll make sure that they treat you right as you go through this. But if you sell candy, boom, they shut you down, treat you like a criminal. If you sell little dolls, don't you think that's wrong?
But you know, I think that the notion is that you're preying on the lack of judgment, I guess, would be for a
you're selling it for 10 cents, 25, you're buying it for 10 cents, selling it for 25. And we're talking about penny commerce to teach you entrepreneurship and encourage this talent that you've given.
Their argument would probably be that there are better ways to teach and encourage entrepreneurship. You know, this it wasn't as if, you know, they strung me up in front of the whole school and made a huge deal about it. It was just one of these.
So did they teach you entrepreneurship in a different way?
No.
No, they missed that. And you're given a talent. I mean, if it's a Quaker school, they should think that it's a God-given talent and encourage it. And if it's a public school, they should think it's a, I don't know, Big Bang-given talent, but encourage it.
It was not a very religious school, that which is so on our end. So not much about God, but
all right.
I certainly encouraged it, but probably in their own ways. Was it right or wrong to stop me from selling animals? Who knows? Certainly wasn't hurting anybody, that's for sure. As you know, the bureaucratic policies of larger organizations, whether it be schools or government or big companies, don't always make sense.
I'm indignant.
That's why we all do what we do.
I'm indignant, my friend. All right. So you're working at Clear Channel. Where did the idea that became CrowdTwist come from?
Yeah, so, you know, as I've said at length now, we were really looking for an idea to latch ourselves onto. And I started and ran the digital marketing and social platforms division at Clear Channel within the online group. And one of the things I was responsible for was our loyalty platform. And we have this loyalty platform across all of our stations, which was effective at driving engagement, very effective at driving engagement. But what never made any sense to me was that the kind of engagement we were driving was not the engagement that was actually valuable to our brands.
What kind of engagement were you guys driving?
Page views.
Page views.
Basically.
So what was it typically like?
In a recorded area of the website.
Ah, okay. Page views to... Sorry, go ahead. We've got a little bit of
time. You know, we're driving engagement and a cordoned off, you know, what we didn't feel was a very well-branded or very well-integrated experience as a part of our radio station sites. And I looked across and said, you know, there are so many areas that are more important for us to drive engagement and build brand affinity with that are being completely missed by this platform. And not only that, but it wasn't very well integrated. The technology wasn't current with what really people are doing and using today. And we just saw an immense opportunity in that alone, because we did see the power of what rewards and points could do, but what was lacking.
Did you have rewards and points at Clear Channel?
This was the platform we were running.
So can you help me understand what the process was like at Clear Channel, what you were working on and how did it work? Was it just tweet, send people to a page if they went
to? No, it wasn't any of that. It was a platform that we licensed from a third party company, and it was literally, you know, take a poll, take a quiz, play a slot machine game. It was actions that really didn't have much of anything to do with our stations.
And then when a user did it, he got points?
Yep. And the points could be used for varying types of rewards.
Like t-shirts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that type of thing. Yeah, you know, not even that. Sometimes the opportunity to get a t-shirt, or, you know, there were different ways in which they built the programs, but there was so much opportunity that was left on the table. That was very, very clear to us.
Okay. And the way that they got people to those sites was basically announcing it on the radio?
Yeah, the radio is a powerful promotional vehicle. It was part of our sites. So it was part of the radio station experience. So they could promote it through the site, promote it through the actual radio station itself.
Okay. All right. And your co-founder, where was he at the time?
So he was at Clear Channel with me initially, and then he moved from Clear Channel to MTV. And while he was at MTV, the other kind of catalyst for us was he was working with some of the biggest artists in the world who were coming and saying, listen, we've got these massive fan clubs, and the whole goal is to put the best tickets in the hands of our best fans. But oftentimes we think we have up to 50% of the people in our clubs who are actually scalpers. So not only are we not getting the best tickets to our fans, but we're actually hurting our fans because the scalpers are getting the tickets at face value and then selling them to the biggest fans at 5 or 6x profit. But we have no idea how to figure out who's a scalper and who's a real fan. And sort of put two and two together, and we said, you know, if you built a rewards program that didn't just drive page views, but actually drove brand valuable actions, and coupled that then with the data that you were able to get back about the people who were engaging, not only would you drive substantially more brand value on one end, but the understanding that you would get back could help you know and understand your audience in a more effective manner than you ever had before. So we were solving both of those problems in a really compelling way. And as we started to think about it more, and I think why did we follow our hearts with crowdsource more than our prior ideas, was the first idea that we started to think about it more and more, we gained more conviction about what we were doing, not less. And we just felt more and more like this was the right idea for us. And it evolved from there.
One thing you discovered in the ticketing business seems to me was that the real customer wasn't the person who was buying the ticket. The real customer was the venue who was getting paid massively and having to sign big contracts with the ticketing company, right? And it was their frustrations and their needs that you had to take into account, and their contractual obligations that you had to take into account. It seems like the same thing here, that if you were going to build a loyalty program, that it wasn't the end user's needs and frustrations that you needed to cater to. It was someone else's. Who was it?
I think really what we like to say is we have two customers in some regard. We have the clients who we sell to, the big brands who license our platform and our technology, who we need to make sure that they feel good about what we're doing, the platform that we're offering. But equally, their end users and their customers are our clients and customers as well. Because if those people aren't happy, if they're not gaining benefit from the solution, if they're not gaining value from the solution, ultimately they won't be happy, nor will the big brands, and then we won't be either. So we need to satisfy both of those parties in the same manner, as you said, that the ticketing business sort of had that dynamic.
So how did you know that the brands had this need, that they cared enough about this to want your product?
I don't think it was how do you know that brands care enough about this? I think for us it was more, this is an idea that makes a lot of sense. Loyalty has been around for decades and decades. And loyalty is a really powerful and valuable tool. To step way back from the radio station world, you know, look at retailers, CPG companies, travel, hotels, I mean, on and on. They've been using loyalty for a really long time and been using it effectively. But what we started to see as we thought about this at a more macro level is that the way loyalty had been built no longer made sense for the landscape that existed today. It was fundamentally focused on the point of sale. It was all about what a customer spends. And the reason that was because that was the only trackable action that you actually had. The only time you knew Andrew was engaging with your brand was when you were actually spending money, whether it was with a credit card or with a card from the retailer or whatever the experience was. I'm never going to tell you that spending money in the point of sale isn't a powerful and important part of customer engagement. Of course it is. But we realized that there were a lot of other areas and places with which people were engaging and creating value and building relationships with brands. You know, the digital landscape had exploded. There was social platforms, there were check-in platforms, there was mobile, there's email marketing, there's online. And so none of these other channels fit into the understanding of loyalty from traditional players. And we looked at it and said, you need to be able to build a program that not just tracks and rewards spend, but really recognizes, incentivizes, and rewards fans and customers for all of the value that they create across the entire brand ecosystem. So it's not just limited to spend. It's anytime you're engaging with a brand, anywhere that you're engaging with that brand.
So if I happen to buy a Kelly Clarkson CD from the from her publishing company. They can clearly identify me as taking a step towards being a loyal fan of hers. They can clearly reward me for that. What else would I do that's valuable to them in relationship to her?
Yeah, I mean, any of my clients, whether it's Sony Music or the Dolphins, you know, there's so many places you're touching the brand, you're engaging with the brand. It could be a social channel, so the influence that you're able to exert across a Facebook or a Twitter. It could be the influence in your ability to check in at a location, driving you to actually be on premise via Foursquare check-in. It's reading emails and engaging in email marketing campaigns.
I see. So if I show up to get her autograph somewhere and I check in on Foursquare, you want to be able to give me a reward for doing that. If I tweet out that she has a new video and my friends go and click to watch it, then you want to reward me for helping to promote her, for caring that much about her.
It's about recognizing value that people are creating for brands. I think from a consumer level, we think about our product and a lot of times from a consumer perspective. And consumers are very aware of the value that they're creating for the brands that they patronize. And they're aware that they're creating value many times earlier than when they spend money and far after when they spend money. And that tweet that you send out has some element of value. That Foursquare check-in you make has some element of value. The fact that you're taking time to read the email campaign, click in, that has value. Going to the website, consuming content, sharing content, all of that has some element of value for a brand. And so what we're simply saying to our clients is, it's important that you recognize the value that your fans are creating for you everywhere that they're creating. And that's an expectation that consumers have and are going to continue to have even more as the discussion about data only heats up.
All right. You told us how you met Josh, your co-founder, but neither you nor Josh are intense developers, right?
Nope.
You needed to find somebody to build this idea out. How did you find Mike, your technical co-founder?
Very serendipitously, I guess, is the answer. You hinted at this in the beginning. We looked around and, you know, we were going to meetups and we were talking to as many people as we could and doing everything that people nowadays do when they're looking for a technical person to join their team. And we'd made the clear decision that it made more sense for us to bring somebody on the team who was really invested in the project versus hiring a shop or a development team to just kind of build what we needed. And we put an ad on Craigslist. We had a couple of ads on Craigslist and we had a number of people who responded and who were interested. And we, you know, get the resume one day of this guy and we look at him and we're like, wow, no way this guy is who he actually says he is. And we go and meet him at the Starbucks around the corner. And we met him and he was a fantastic guy and did in fact do all the things that it said on his resume. And on top of it, he was a great person. And we were kind of like, wow, there just something doesn't add up. Something doesn't make sense. And we continued to talk to him. We continued to chat with him. And truth be told, it was real serendipity. I mean, he was incredibly talented. He had done this a number of times before successfully, was a fantastic and phenomenal developer, and had a lot of passion for the same ideas that we were chasing. And so it was a great match.
What kind of ad do you write on Craigslist that leads you to find a guy like Michael Montero?
It was a short ad, actually. Someone asked me about it about 6 or 8 months ago, and I dredged it up and looked at it. I don't remember it exactly, but it was only like 5 lines, I think. So it was short.
Do you remember the gist of it? Were you saying, hey, I'm looking for a technical co-founder to launch a business in the loyalty program space?
It sounds kind of cliche now because I feel like everybody's looking for a ninja. But I think at the time, admittedly, we said ninja in our post, in the headline of the post, I think it said, you know, at the time we were a music startup as well. We were Better Fan Clubs for Musicians was the first incarnation. And so it was, you know, music startup looking for ninja CTO or something of that sort. And, you know, just gave a couple lines, you know, experience in the industry, looking for somebody great. And he responded.
And then once you meet him,
more in some regards, probably.
How do you win him over once you meet him? Is it giving him equity? Is it something else?
I think it's about fit. I mean, you know, he appreciated the vision we had for the product. He appreciated the goal we had in mind for the company and what we wanted to do. And most importantly, the opportunity we saw that was there. And it felt like it was a fit in that regard.
I'm looking here at his Crunchbase profile. It says, Mike co-founded his first company right out of college, Community Connect Inc., which published niche social networks and grew to one of the largest social networking sites at the time. It was sold to Radio One in 2008. Mike's second venture, which he co-founded, Photolog, started in his apartment on a DSL line and grew to the 56th largest site in the world. Photolog was sold in the fall of 2007. And then it talks about City Realty providing services for major companies like Prudential. This is a guy who has a good background. You win him over. Can you just tell me a little bit more about how you win him over? Because I know there's someone in my audience who's saying, I meet great people all the time. I want them to partner with me. What do I say? What's the magic word beyond just fitting?
Winning over, I think, is a tough way to say it, because it's a different thing about for gaining a client. It's different gaining a client than it is for a partner. And it's a different dynamic and it's a different relationship. So you need to, the most important thing I think you need to have is passion, enthusiasm, and excitement for what you're doing and what you're building. It's absolutely critical. Once you have that, you need to find somebody who has the same amount of passion and excitement and enthusiasm and who fits well with you and the business that you're building. And finding that's the most important thing that you can find. You know, winning over somebody who's not going to be a good fit for you ultimately is going to be a bad choice. You want to find that person who's a fit, who shares the passion. And the best way you can get somebody excited who would be a good fit is to be excited yourself. Be able to articulate and express the vision that you have clearly, concisely, but with the passion that you have. Because what people, my belief, what people are attracted to in the early stages are passion, because that's the fodder that you have, right? It's the passion, because that's what drives you forward when you've got no customers, when the features you wanted to build are taking twice as long, when nobody believes and wants to invest. I mean, there's all these typical moments you have in building a company. If you don't have conviction and you don't have passion, it's hard to move through this.
All right. And I want to know, and I will ask you later on about how that passion helped you in some of the tougher times. For now, let's continue with the narrative. You've got Michael interested in this business. The three of you get to work. How long does it take you to launch the first version?
Too long. I think one of the things we probably would have done differently is not build as much as we did to start. You know, there's obviously a lot of talk about the lean startup movement, right or wrong. There's definitely credence to the notion that you don't have to build everything. We launched the product in early summer of 2010. It was hard. I mean, Mike was working, at nights and weekends. I was working nights and weekends. Josh was working nights and weekends. We had a couple of other developers who had joined up and were working with us. They were working, some of them were working full time, but when you don't have everybody focused all the time, it's a difficult thing.
Other developers, how'd you afford to pay other developers to help out?
Josh and Mike and I really made the decision that we were going to fund the business in the early days on our own to get it to a certain point. So that was what we did.
How much money did you guys put in?
Not something we disclosed. But
really?
Okay. Yeah, we put in a fair bit.
Okay.
Between the three of us. I mean, we invested a lot. My belief is if I didn't believe in it, Mike didn't believe in it, Josh didn't believe in it, how could we ask anybody else not to? I mean, we didn't invest, millions and millions of dollars, but we put in a substantial amount of money to afford and to pay a couple of developers. The developers had some equity in themselves, so everybody was incentivized to make this thing work. But, we felt like it didn't make sense for us to go out and raise money until we had a product that we could actually show people. I think the market's even changed now from then, but that was our feeling at the time.
Can I tell you something? I didn't push you earlier when it came to revenues. And I'm not going to push you even here about how much you put in, but I think you should talk about it. I think the amount that you put in doesn't give anything away to your competitors, and it does nothing but show everyone in this space and everyone who you're going to hire how much you believed in it. I'm not going to push you to do it, but I wouldn't ask a second time if I didn't believe that it was important.
It's a fair point. You kind of caught me by surprise, truth be told. Because it has to do with Josh and Mike as well, not just me. I feel like it's right of me. I would need to ask them before I disclose something like that, just because it's not only my finances, it's theirs as well. But suffice it to say, it was, hundreds of thousands were put in by us.
Okay. All right. So you said too long. How long again did it take to build?
Yeah, I don't know the exact time because it's hard to know when we started building, but we launched in summer 2010.
So is that roughly 6 months?
Probably, yeah, somewhere in there, maybe a little bit more, but a little, yeah, probably a little bit more than 6 months. But
okay. And if you had to do it again, you said that maybe you'd go smaller. What would you have taken out of the first launch to get it out the door faster?
I mean, there's all the nuances and the features I can talk about in our product that wouldn't make a lot of sense to the people listening because they don't know our product the way I do. But it was just, there was, after you kind of hit that critical point, like what's the core product you're trying to build? There were probably bells and whistles that we added because they looked good, they sounded good, they made sense. That could we have added in a phase two or a phase three after we were live? Absolutely. Did they absolutely need to be there for the first launch? Certainly not. So I think it's making that distinction between what do you really need to get the product out the door and make it function and drive the results you want, and what are the other things that you can start to add on later? Because the other piece is you learn a ton when you launch your product, a lot that you just never expected.
Like what? Once you launch, what did you learn that you didn't expect?
It was just funny. You know, we tested the hell out of it with the team that we had, but ultimately that was a small group of people, I think five or six of us, you know, between three of the co-founders, our two devs and our designer at the time. And so we're testing it, but that's six people, you know? And so six people is six people using the product. And all of a sudden when you have hundreds of people using the product after you launch, the things that work for six people may not actually work for 100 people. Also, when you have strangers and people you don't know, you're curious about information about them and you want to learn more about the other people in the program, which were dynamics that you never could really see when it was just six people because we knew each other. We weren't really engaging in the program as much as testing the software itself.
Can you give me an example? Take us into, at this point in the interview, we're over half an hour into the interview, so people do know your business. Give us an idea of what you didn't know about it when you launched.
Something as simple as like we felt like, wow, here's hundreds of people who've joined the program who have a share a common interest in that we have as well. And I'm interested in learning more about these other people. Who are they? Like, how do they earn the points that they have? Where are they from? Right. Where do they rank compared to me? Things like this. And that's just not an issue you ever saw with six people or 100 fake user accounts created by six people. That curiosity didn't exist because it was all familiarity. So when you took out the variable of familiarity, there was this curiosity that existed about the community that had built around our program that we hadn't really built a product to cater to. I think that was where we initially iterated.
That makes total sense. If you and I were fans of Mixergy and I saw you on the fan list, I'd think, oh, cool. Irving's using the software. It'll be interesting to see if other entrepreneurs take to it the way that he does. But if it's someone who's listening to us right now who joins the fan community, I'd want to know, who are they? How do they listen? What are they doing with this? Yeah. Are they good entrepreneurs? Or are they just wannabes and so on? All right. So I get that. I get the launch. What I'm wondering is, what was the first fan club for? You didn't have clients by then, right?
Small artist in Brooklyn named Rosie Galan. So okay. That was our first client. And her manager, Dave, was a fantastic guy, is a fantastic guy. And, you know, we met with him and Rosie at B-Bar down on Bowery in New York. And okay. We pitched them the idea. And we had our designer, Ruby, create these nice mock-ups of what it was going to look like for Rosie. And we kind of showed it to them and said, hey, what do you think? And we'll give it to you. Can we launch with you guys? And they loved it and they loved the concept. And they said, absolutely. And we just, for us, as we built the company, we thought it was a lot better to have somebody actually using it in live versus trying to go out to people and explain the concept without having anything to show.
And you picked Rosie because she was a smaller artist who hadn't broken through big yet, and so she'd be easier to work with without red tape, without a million managers. And
yeah, I mean, she's had a really successful career. She's a very successful artist, actually, and Dave's a great manager. It was just that we had a good relationship with Dave. We felt like we could work with him. She was the kind of size where, to your point, there wasn't the red tape and the bureaucracy, and we could get something up and running with minimal disruptions.
And you knew about her because you worked at Clear Channel, and she... Yeah. And what was her connection to Clear Channel?
I had just, you know, one of the things I did was ran the content team for a period of time. So knew a lot of artists and managers and labels and folks like that.
You know what? Let's talk a little bit about this value of having been an employee before starting a business. So many times entrepreneurs say, I would never, and anytime anyone says I would never, you think that they're not thinking. But a lot of entrepreneurs say I would never get a job. And here, as you and I talk, I see that getting a job at Clear Channel and having other work experience opened you up to opportunities and understanding of the market that you wouldn't have had if you were just an outsider here. You found your first partner through Clear Channel. What else did you learn as a result of working for Clear Channel?
I learned a lot working for all the companies I worked for, you mm-hmm. know, in my career. And that, you know, I think that I would never tell anyone that there's a right and a wrong path to take. For some folks, diving right into the world of entrepreneurship makes a lot of sense. For other folks, having some structured experience and exposure is extraordinarily valuable. You know, I think certainly the climate that we're in right now, I think it's great for technology and for entrepreneurs, is there's more opportunity today than there has been for really a long, long time. And for people who've never worked anywhere, there's places where they can get involved and early stage companies they could get involved in, and there's just more opportunity in general. So I think it's a great thing. For me, first of all, you know, when I was first interested in kind of getting involved in technology, I just hadn't had a business background as much in college, and I thought that having some training and background was going to be valuable. And that was why I'd chosen to go into finance. But I stayed in the world of finance. I stayed in the part of finance that was relevant to where I wanted to be. So I was helping early stage companies actually raise venture capital. So I was working with the types of companies I eventually wanted to be involved with myself. So I learned something there through that experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone told me a long while ago, you know, it can be valuable to learn on somebody else's dime at some point. And so, again, for some that's true. For others who just have an idea and a burning passion for a specific problem and they just say, this is what I need to do, this is what I need to solve, I'm going to go out and do it. Thank God we have the ecosystem that we do now that people can go follow their dreams and passions immediately. But for others, I think, particularly if you're building a company that's focused on enterprises and brands and bigger businesses, having spent time at a bigger business, at a company, understanding how the politics work, how decisions are made, how things get done, how quickly or slowly things can move, that's really valuable when you're on the other side, when you're in a company trying to work with these types of companies. I think managing your expectations can be really effective and helpful.
I started my first company right out of school. We had two different ideas. The great idea needed partnerships with big companies like AOL. I didn't know the first thing about how to get in the door there. And I was just trying for weeks and getting frustrated for a long time. And then I finally went with a simpler idea that didn't require big partnerships. But if I had spent a little bit of time at those companies or working at any company, I might have had an understanding of how to network my way in, of how the business worked, as you said. I don't regret it. I'm just saying it would have been an interesting option and a useful option in that case.
And I don't think that there's a right or wrong path. You know, like one of my great friends, you know, Wiley Cirelli, just had a fantastic exit for his company, Single Platform to Constant Contact. And, you know, he, before Single Platform, was one of the earliest employees at Seamless Web. So he never spent time at big established organizations. I mean, very, very quick stints at early companies, but he had never spent time in a big company. But the time he spent at Seamless Web gave him valuable experience and exposure that eventually helped him start this company, Single Platform. So there is no right path. There's no prescribed path necessarily that one needs to follow. I think it's about what's right for you, what makes sense for you at the time, with what your skills are, with what you want to do.
All right. So how did you get the next clients? Did you need funding in order to get the next artist or business to partner with you?
I think we did start to raise funding at the time. So we were lucky to close an initial seed round in September 2010. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say that was a requirement for us to get clients. Really, what started to happen is we just started to talk to more and more folks about what we were doing, and it really resonated with people. And it resonated not just in the world of music, but it almost resonated more powerfully outside of music, because brands realized, hey, we're no different than an artist, and the same problems that artists have, which is, you know, a distributed base of customers and fans across many different platforms and channels, is the problem that we have as a brand. And oftentimes brands have bigger budgets and sometimes more savvy as well. So our ability to take what we are doing in the world of music and transfer it and translate it over to bigger brands, it just made a lot of sense. And we were lucky enough to sign Live Nation as a client in the late fall of 2010. And we ended up running a very, very successful program with them. And that was a great catalyst for the business.
How'd you get into Live Nation's office?
You know, a friend referred us. He knew the head of someone who worked there and ran one of their big festivals, and said, "Hey, you should check out this company and the technology they've got. It's great." And he sent it over to this guy, John Desposito. John looked at it and said, "Hey, this is exactly what I want to do." And we came into his office and we talked to him. He's like, "I love it. This is what I want. I like to be innovative. Let's do it." And that was sort of the beginning.
Did John help you shape the product back then too?
I think it was less about helping to shape the product, more about giving it a much more powerful megaphone to talk to people about what we actually
do. So how did John want to use the platform? What was he going to reward, and what was he going to give people who collected those points?
What was cool is that John's vision for the platform was exactly what our vision was for the platform, which I think why he was a great early client, was he wanted to engage and activate his audience across all the different channels where they were engaging with this festival. You know, that was Twitter, that was Facebook, that was on their website. You know, they had Bamboozle Radio, looking through their photo galleries, engaging with their artists. And then, of course, buying tickets was important to them as well. So this notion of cross-channel engagement and multi-channel loyalty was really at the core of what he wanted to do and what we were offering. So there was a great intersection there. And then secondarily, one of our core competencies, one of the things that we were really focused on, is not building traditional reward programs that, you know, give you $10 off for every $200 you spend. But this notion of giving experiences and access and status and opportunities that money can't necessarily buy. And John wanted to give away not things like, "Hey, get a free hot dog at the Bamboozle Festival," but more importantly, announce your favorite band on stage, or get to go to a photo shoot with your favorite band, or a drum lesson with, you know, such and such band, or a signed drumstick, and things like this that were really special and exciting to his fans. So his vision, not just for the platform, but also for the rewards, were very much in line with what our vision was.
I see. All right. And you mentioned earlier there are times in a business where things just aren't working, but your passion will help carry you forward. For you, there were times when people just weren't getting the idea. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you got past the moment where, for every person who said this is a good idea, 10 people were telling you it's not going to work?
I think every entrepreneur is going to tell you that they've been through the experience where people are going to tell them that's a bad idea, it's not going to work, that's going to fail, or every reason under the sun of why your vision isn't going to ever come into reality. And, you know, I think we had plenty of instances, whether it was when we were raising funding in the early days and people didn't believe in the music space necessarily, they were concerned about music or concerned about varying aspects of our business and if we'd be able to take it to the next level. And then when we were talking to early companies and they were trying to understand what it all actually meant and why the platform made sense. And I think there was just that ability to stay positive, continue to maintain conviction and passion for what we were doing, and iterate and evolve the story and evolve the pitch and evolve the product to a point where it did resonate with clients. It did make sense to them. It did resonate with investors. And, you know, I think we've been really lucky, and I'm incredibly appreciative that we've been able to do that.
What's one iteration that you took that had significant impact on getting new clients?
I think it was moving away from music solely. We spent a lot of time focused on the world of music, and I think, you know, selfishly we really wanted to reinvent the music space in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of people have wanted to do that. And we started to realize that while that was a noble mission and something that we wanted to do for the sake of the business to be really effective, we needed to broaden beyond the world of music. We needed to bring our platform and services to many more people. And that was absolutely the right decision, because as we did that, we started to really pick up traction and interest across the board.
What about Techstars? At what point did you guys decide to apply to be in Techstars?
We met Dave Tisch in the fall, late fall of 2011, or 2010 rather. And,
who was running the New York?
He was running, he's the managing director. It was the first time there'd been a program for Techstars in New York. And we walked around the park with him and talked about CrowdTwist and what we were doing. And he was really interested in the idea and he liked the concept and told us about Techstars. We didn't know a lot about it before then. And kind of looked at it and said, yeah, we'll certainly apply. And we applied for the program and we were lucky enough to get accepted in the first round and then the second round. And then went in and interviewed with David Tisch and David Cohen and were offered a spot in the first New York program and took it.
So they don't give you a ton of money. You invested more of your own money than they invested in your business. But how did they help you beyond that? How did they help you shape the product, for example?
Yeah, I mean, so interestingly enough, Techstars has now evolved themselves. And so I think that they give founders or companies now substantially more than was given back when we were.
Right.
In the program.
Right.
I'm not sure the exact sum, but 100,000 or something like that.
Right.
But still, $100,000 isn't going to make or break anybody's business. It's a great start. It's a helpful start, but it's not the end all be all. To me, Techstars is much, much more about the network that they've built, the network of companies, the network of mentors, and the exposure and the experience that you gain over the course of the 3 months in the program.
So what's one specific thing that you got out of being in the program?
We just met an incredible amount of people. I mean, incredible mentors, former entrepreneurs, current investors, folks at big companies. I mean, just champions in many areas and walks of business life, and people who were excited about what we were doing, excited about the vision of the company itself, made phenomenal introductions in a number of different places, and just really had a vested interest in seeing us successful.
Okay. What about one of the other customers? We talked about Live Nation. Can you tell me about how you got either Miami Dolphins or maybe Pepsi or Sony Music?
Yeah, I mean, we,
it's an impressive roster you guys have.
Yeah, I think it's, our focus has been twofold. First of all, there's people in the world and people who we see sometimes who believe in selling before you've got a product. We really believed in building a world-class, a best-in-class product, and then rolling that out to a set of clients that made a lot of sense for our different verticals. And I think when we brought the product we did with the vision that we did, it really resonated for those folks. And we met Sony, ironically, after we'd sort of separated from music, we met Sony as they were looking to really build a broader reward loyalty opportunity across all the Sony artists. We met Zumiez, which is one of the biggest action sports retailers in the country. They had an association with Live Nation. They'd seen our software and they found it was very interesting as they were thinking about loyalty as a company internally. And we had a number of conversations with them. They reached out to us and we ultimately went out to Seattle and we spent time with the entire management team. We loved the team. We loved the vision for what they wanted to do. I think they were really excited about us as a team and what we were looking to do. And it was a fit.
All right. Let me tell people about if they want to take the next step with Mixergy, what they can do. And then I want to come back and ask you one final question about what your advice is for someone who wants big clients like the ones who I just mentioned, who you've been successful enough to land. So if you're watching this interview and you want more with Mixergy, go to mixergypremium.com. What's Mixergy Premium? Well, you know how as an entrepreneur, you guys in the audience, we get, as entrepreneurs, we all actually have issues that we come up with. Like maybe we create a landing page and we're not getting enough people to fill in their email address on the landing page or to buy from that landing page. At Mixergy, we have a course from Dan Soroker of Optimizely where he teaches what he learned about increasing conversions. His product Optimizely is more popular now than Google Website Optimizer. And so he's watched a lot of companies use it and increase their conversions. I asked him to come on and teach how to increase conversions. What's another problem that we have? How to handle customer service. So we have a course on coming up soon about how to improve your customer service. If you're getting flooded with emails, how do you handle those emails? How do you respond to them in a way that makes people understand that they're heard? How do you even anticipate some of the problems that you're going to have and handle them before the emails come in? We've got a course on that coming up at mixergypremium.com. All these issues that we have as entrepreneurs, I go out there and I find entrepreneurs who are especially good at them, at handling those issues, and I bring them on and ask them to turn on their computers, show us how they solve those problems for themselves, and teach us how we can do it too. So that basically is what Mixergy Premium is. And if you join right now and you don't love it as much as I do and as much as thousands of other people do, let me know and I'll give you a 100% refund. But my bet is that you're going to love it. You're going to stay subscribed and you're going to get infinitely more value out of it than you're going to pay thousands of dollars, I would say, for every dollar that you pay to be a part of MixergyPremium.com. So go there and join now. And I look forward to having you on board. All right. What is your advice, Irving, for someone who wants to land the kind of clients that you have, Pepsi, Sony, et cetera?
I think there's a lot of different areas to that. I think the first is you got to make, it sounds so simple and intuitive, but you got to build something that those folks are looking for that solves a real problem for them. You got to recognize that the bigger brands, these bigger companies are pitched all the time by existing technologies, but also new technologies who want to solve their problems. So understanding what the most acute pain points that those folks have, where do they need to prioritize getting resolution to problems? What are the most important issues that they're having and how can you build something that solves that? Or more importantly, if you've built the product, who are the big brands that have, who value solving the problem that you're solving as much as you do? So make sure, as they say, fish where the fish are in that regard. I think the second piece is persistence. You've got to have patience and persistence with big companies. As much as you want them to move at the speed that startups move, they don't. There's just more complexities, more people involved, more decisions that need to be made. So you need to stay persistent. You need to stay on top of these folks, continue to move the process forward. But you also need to be patient and recognize that it's going to take some time. And I think that you need to cast a wide net. You need to talk to as many people as you can because not everything's going to hit, not everything's going to close. That's the nature of business. But exposing yourself to as many different opportunities as you can is going to give you the highest likelihood of finding some great partners. And momentum begets momentum. So success with big clients begets more success with other big clients begets more success with other big clients. It's a network effect in that regard.
All right. It's a good place to leave it. Thank you for doing this interview. And anyone who wants to see the business that we've been talking about can go to crowdtwist.com. And of course, thank you again, Techstars, for introducing me to Irving and so many other great entrepreneurs. Oh, one more thing. Speaking of introducing me to other great entrepreneurs, Wiley from Single Platform. Can you introduce me to him after this interview's over?
He's got a lot going on right now with all that's just happened, but I certainly can make it.
I'll shoot you an email. If you just pass it on to him, even if he's not interested today, I will continue doing these interviews for probably the rest of my life. Just tapping him today and saying that the opportunity is here. Maybe we'll get him to do the interview. And if not, maybe I'll do it again. Maybe I'll do it sometime in the future.
He's a great speaker, so I hope he does.
Now I want him for sure. All right. I'll follow up with you. Thank you all for watching.
Great. Thank you.